Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. I am Matt Perslow and today with me is Jesse Gomez.
Hello.
Hello, Jesse.
I hope you've all had a lovely day.
Yeah, we're recording. It's quite a late recording today, so you feeling ready to clock off, Jesse?
I'm so excited to relax and watch some nice TV after this.
Lovely. Well, today we have a very special guest with us coming all the way from his time off. It's Simon Cardi.
Oh, hello, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, people thought they'd have a week off of me. No dice, I'm afraid. It is my week off, but do you know what? I've answered the call. I am here to talk about some things I've been playing and watching, because that's what we do on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You've always got that podcast itch. You're always ready just to spring to action.
I just like to have someone to speak to. It's been a long week.
I'm just feeling lonely. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're specifically here, Cardi, because when we had a new game from Nintendo in, you decided that you were going to be the one to play it, and
yes.
Then took a week
a brave
off
soul.
To go and yes. play it. So we had to summon you back in to say, Simon Cardi, can you please tell us all about Pokemon? I don't know which version you've got. Have you got,
Ooh.
Is it Brilliant, Diamond, and Shining Pearl, or the other
which
way around?
Which one do you think I have?
You seem like a Pearl kind of
no,
lad.
No, I reckon you've got Diamond.
I am a Diamond geezer.
Oh,
Matt knew it. I am playing Brilliant Diamond, and I'm having a lovely time with it because I like this era of Pokemon, kind of the Gold Silver generation is my favorite, but then Ruby, yeah. Sapphire, Diamond and Pearl, the ones that came afterwards, are kind of also very good. I think it's after this they tailed off a bit for me, but I like this era of Pokemon because it's where you're doing different stuff. It's taken the core, you know, Pokemon of going town to town and doing gyms, but it's also adding a few more fun elements to the mix to make it not as linear. And I feel like it's past this point where you get to like some of the more complicated stuff where they're just throwing so many different mechanics into the mix that it's all just a bit like, I don't know, I just want to play, you know, I want to go back to basics and play Red and Blue again. So this is kind of like a sweet spot for me because Diamond and Pearl, you've got the classic Pokemon journey. If you set off from your town, your mum gives you your bag and your running shoes or whatever, and you're off to catch every Pokemon and become the best. And
yeah,
everyone knows how Pokemon works, I think, by now, you know. And you're going town to town defeating gyms, but it's also got the thing that Sword and Shield didn't do, which is you've got this kind of like enemy organization called Team Galactic. And if you've like these, we should say these are remasters of what, like a 15-year-old game at this point?
Yeah, they're from like the early DS era, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that it's roughly 15 years. And
yeah,
so like if you've played those games, you are just getting those games again, but in remastered 3D, and it looks lovely and it plays lovely. But
is it a remaster or is it a remake? Does it look like Sword and Shield, but it's using the same game
it's
system?
It's not quite Sword and Shield level. It looks more like, you know, when they did the Let's Go version. So mm-hmm. it's like,
yeah.
and like all the characters look like massive children rather than adults. They're really weird character models that I quite enjoyed. Almost like chibi-fied in a way.
Yeah.
But I'm just having a nice time because it's like, it's what I need this week. I think when I've got my time off, I can just like put on some TV, some mindless TV and some mindless Pokemon that I can play in my sleep and just kind of play through it. And that's what I'm saying, like Sword and Shield didn't really do this, whereas Diamond and Pearl does, which is you still got those like sight almost like things that take you off the beaten path. So like Sword and Shield kind of just didn't last very long, and I found it quite dull because you were just literally going, like we're saying, town to town doing gym battles. The roads between those gyms were like 2 minutes long. There was no real challenge, whereas this time like you're going into like long caves, you're going into buildings where you have to defeat lots of people, and those are the bits I always liked about Pokemon. And you're getting that in this, plus just what makes the originals great. Yeah, I'm having a lovely time with it.
how much of a Pokemon game do you usually play? Like, do you see it all the way through? Are you just kind of like, I've got my fill now, and now I'm kind of done?
I normally finish it, do the Elite Four, and then play a little bit of the post game. I never really, like, back in the old days, like, when the originals came out, I would try and collect every Pokemon. I don't do that anymore. Like, I kind of just complete the quest and then stop. That's what's good about Diamond Pearl is it's quite lengthy. Like, I've got 5 or 6 badges out of the 8 now, and I'm 23, 24 hours in. Like, it's like a 40-hour game, like, if you do everything. And that's what I'm enjoying. Like, you're not getting shortchanged in this game at all.
And do you think, you know, like, I know you've discussed, like, what sort of a remake/remaster it is.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you like the new feeling of it? Is it worth that kind of upgrade?
I would say, are you getting much more from it if you already had the DS version and you still have your DS? Like, are you getting much more from just picking that up and playing it? Probably not. It does look a lot nicer. It loads a lot quicker. Like, it's nice just to, like, the battles are now 3D and you see the effects come in properly. And, like, I think the original DS ones were, you know, they were kind of 2.5D-ish. Like, I don't have very strong memories of Diamond, Pearl, Ruby and Sapphire is the last one I remember, like, vividly. So this one's kind of like, I'm half remembering things as I go on, but I'm just, I'm having a nice time. I've named my rival Ham, so every time he encounters me, it's like Ham wants to fight, so...
Lovely.
I don't know. Yeah. What is it with you? Like, your Spartan tag is Ham.
It's Ham. Well. I don't know. It's just I go in and out of naming things, and, like, at the moment, whenever I'm asked to name something custom in a game, I'm just going for Ham.
That's not a bad name.
I've got currently, like, I always do this with Pokemon. I try and mix it up every time I play it and not just get the same old Pokemon, but I end up just building the same party as ever just because they're trusty and reliable. Like, I always
from,
like,
the original 151.
Not quite, but whenever I play a Pokemon, like, one of my favourite Pokemon is Golduck. I always need to have a Golduck in there. I love Golduck. Not only is he very powerful, you got your Psychic and your Water moves and your Ice, but, like, he's just a cool-looking Pokemon. And it means you get to have Psyduck with you for a long time as well. So I've got my Golduck. I'm having a lovely time.
Who was your starting Pokemon, Cardi?
I went for Turtwig. I went for the grass Pokemon, so I've currently got him fully evolved. So he's basically a big tortoise with a tree growing on his shell. And I think the one thing that I'd forgotten about Diamond Pearl that I'm enjoying a lot, and it's similar, like, I just sometimes like these quite mundane things in games is the Grand Underground system where you do all the mining. It kind of reminds me of, like, it's one of the more dull parts of Mass Effect 2, but when you're doing the mining and you're just doing the probing around all the planets, I find that I was doing that for, like, an hour at a time. Just, it was quite smooth, quite soothing, putting on, like, some music or, like, half watching something while doing that. And that's what I'm doing in the underground, like, in Brilliant Diamond. You kind of, if you don't understand what that is, like, a few hours into the game, you get an explorer's kit, which means you can go underground, and below the full world map is a whole set of underground tunnels that are very extensive, and you can just go around and just basically take a pickaxe to a wall, and then you just get, like, mini puzzles whenever you do that, and you need to find some, like, gemstones. Maybe you'll find a thunderstone or a fossil. It's just nice. It's a nice little, you know, sometimes it's nice to go fossil hunting. You know, my dad likes to do that. He goes to Lyme Regis just, like, 2 times a year with his little hammers and tries to find fossils. So maybe I'm following in my father's footsteps through Pokemon Brilliant Diamond. What an emotional story. It's been a big week off for me. I've discovered a lot about myself.
Clearly. And in terms of other things that you've done on your week off, Cardi, you were speaking to me not so long ago. You've finished Arcane, a show that I recommended. Not so long ago.
I think we briefly spoke about this when you'd watched, what, the first 2 or 3 episodes?
All 9 episodes are now out on Netflix, and I think IGN gave it a 10 as, like, a series score.
Jesus.
And I think both me and Cardi can wholeheartedly say it's a show worth watching.
Well, I think it's hard to argue against that 10 after watching it, and this is, like, coming from me who, A, never has played a single second of League of Legends in his life. Obviously, we've done our documentary about KDA before. I like all the Riot Music stuff and what they've done with that before. And just the animation in this show, I think we talked about before, it's second to none. And and I'm not a huge animated TV person anyway. Like, I'm not big into any sort of anime. I'm not, like, massively into animated films either, but for some reason this just grabbed me and I couldn't stop watching. And yeah, for characters I previously knew nothing about, but like, it's remarkable how much they make you care about these characters.
Yeah, like, it's, I think the thing I love about it so much is how character focused it is. It's very world oriented, and it kind of builds these two, like the story of this incredible kind of city called Piltover that has like these slum areas, and the, you know, mm-hmm. this slum wants to be independent, and they are to a degree cast as kind of the villains, but also very, very sympathetic villains, and you understand mm-hmm. that they're fighting for their freedom. You know, they want to be free of this kind of like oppressive, like upper class regime that's in like Piltover, and they want to be their own nation. And I think like that's a like quite a resonant sort of idea in kind of the world. But the way that it uses those characters and pulls them apart and pulls them back together again over, like, what's that show set over? Like, maybe, like, it's got, like, a good kind of, like, 5 or 6 year time gap, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first 3 episodes, yeah, take place over the course of a day or two. And then, mm-hmm. yeah, we fast forward in time for the other 6 episodes taking place. I don't know what must be roughly 10 years in the future, mm-hmm. maybe. And, yeah, when it made that time jump, that's when I really fell in. I really enjoyed the first 3 episodes, but episodes 4, 5, 6, 7 especially for me were just unbelievable. Like, it ends very well as well, but like, there's so many great moments, like the opening to, I think, like, there's so many, you can listen to the whole album now as well, which is mm-hmm. amazing. Like, the music they've made for this show is, if you're into like KDA or True Damage or any of the music Riot have made for it, you'll find something to love here, because it did the impossible. It made me like an Imagine Dragons song, which is like, you know, a show is a 10 out of 10 when even Imagine Dragons are passable in it. And mm-hmm. yeah, it's the, I think my favorite bit was the end of episode 7. There's a fight sequence where kind of it switches into a different animation style for a full minute and starts playing this song that also has like a ticking, like a stopwatch. I bet you know the bit I'm talking about, Matt. It's just unbelievable animation. Like, it's just so cool. And yeah, I've finished watching it and I've just been going back and watching scenes over and over again, like their music videos. Like, yeah. It's unbelievably good.
Like, honestly, I think for me, it's kind of like, I thought I'd never see animation that I enjoyed more than Spider-Man's Into the Spider-Verse. And for me, mm-hmm. I think, and part of it is just because I love the world design of like Piltover, especially that very stylish steampunk stuff, which calls a lot back to kind of like the look of Dishonored.
But exactly, I was thinking Dishonored and like Bioshock Infinite as well at times. I was like, I'm well into this.
mm-hmm. But the way that kind of like, it does these kind of like 3D characters over 2D backdrops, but the characters are like colored in with 2D planes, so they look like they're watercolored to a degree. Like, that combined with the visual style and the variety of the characters, I just think is absolutely astonishing.
How much does it introduce like the world of League of Legends? Because I think back to like, you know, maybe prior animated shows or films, like the World of Warcraft film, where, you know, it tries to cram in so much. Like, you said it there, Cardi, like, you don't know anything about League of Legends. Mm-hmm. Same for me, but it's not overwhelming, and it's done obviously well, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Like, yeah, they do an incredible job at world building instantly. And like, it's just, I think they do that great thing of making the start so relatable. Like, it starts on a very small scale. It's just like you get to know these kids, which is like, everyone can relate to that. Everyone's been a child. And then it builds like slowly, like over the course of 9 episodes, it does a lot in that time, but it's never overwhelming. Mm. Like, it never feels too much. And like,
How long are these episodes?
40
like
minutes.
40 minutes. So yeah.
That seems really, like, I'm quite excited. I was going to watch an episode yesterday, but I just didn't get a chance to do it. And to hear like, because I've only heard like from people who love League of Legends saying this is fantastic. And to hear obviously someone who has no experience in it saying it's really good. Like, that's
Oh, it's easily awesome. One of the best things I've seen this year. Easily.
But I think, like, for anybody at home that has kind of watched this show and is just like, well, where do I go next? It's interesting that actually Riot dropped a whole new video game, like, just as Arcane came to an end. So there is a new game called Ruined King, a League of Legends story, which is a sort of RPG, but JRPG-styled role-playing game that's based in the Rune Terror world, which is where League of Legends is set. And so kind of like, if you're looking for somewhere to go beyond the show, but you don't, where you look at League of Legends and think, I don't want to play a 5v5 MOBA that's got no story. Mm. Well, Ruined King, I think, is certainly from what I've played of it so far, is the game to go for. Wow. So It's definitely, like, unfortunately, it has not got a budget to contend with the like of Arcane or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it's a, imagine like a Diablo kind of perspective, top-down RPG.
Okay.
But it's not set in Piltover. It actually introduces you to a completely different side of Runeterra. It goes over to Bilgewater, which is the pirate town. And you're playing, your initial character is Lady, is Miss Fortune, who is essentially a kind of like this pirate-style lady that has just defeated Gangplank, who is the leader of Bilgewater, and she's now sort of inherited kind of power over this town. And so it, what it does then is, because it's a party-based RPG, like something like a Final Fantasy would be, it starts to pull in other champions from League of Legends and bring their stories into it. But I think the clever thing it does is it brings people from very, very different areas of Runeterra into it. So you then meet Illaoi, who is kind of like, she's almost got like an African tribe sort of vibe to it. And she's got characters with her, and her personal story is very much to do with, she is kind of like connected to their gods, and she can sort of like see, like she's able to hear messages from their gods to kind of judge people and stuff like that. You then get Braum, who is from like their Nordic sort of side. He's very kind of big, like a very gentle giant sort of thing, but he's got a Viking sort of element to him. You then meet Yasuo, who is, I hope I'm pronouncing all of these names right, by the way, for anybody that is a big League fan. Even though the voices are, it's a voiced RPG for kind of like probably 60% of it. But I do quite often forget how you pronounce these things. But he's, Yasuo is more of a, like a ninja, like a samurai kind of warrior. Okay. And he's got a, someone that he's bought to Bilgewater on like a pilgrimage. And she's kind of like, you don't, it does eventually reveal who it is, and I'm not going to say for, you know, spoiler reasons, but the way it does that, like he's bringing this mysterious woman across kind of the seas to this town. And basically, like, the storyline unites all of these people together and realizes that kind of like they've got a shared kind of journey to take. And then it becomes like this party-based RPG, which is, as say, from a top-down perspective in terms of exploring the world, it's a little bit Diablo-y. But when you come across enemies, it's like a Final Fantasy game where you've got your team on the left of the screen and the enemy team on the right.
So it's turn-based?
It is turn-based, okay. But what it has is a very interesting approach to the way that you do battle. So the, at the bottom of the screen, there's kind of like a timeline, almost like kind of like in video editing, I suppose, and it plots on that where everyone's next turn is going to be. Mm-hmm. And so when you, so you can either do instant attacks, which will do you here and now and then push you further down the track for when your next turn comes up. Or you can do what are called lane abilities, and kind of that laning stuff, like, I guess, is a throwback to League of Legends actually being set on lanes. But here it's a case of that timeline is split up into three bars. So the top one is speed, the middle one is regular, and the bottom one is power. So if you start to do a lane attack, you can, on regular, it will do a certain amount of damage, and it will do a certain amount of kind of other magical or physical kind of debuffs or stuff like that. If you opt to do it at speed, you won't have the delay on the cast. Your delay will be a lot shorter, but it won't do as much power. Whereas if you opt for power, it puts you further, it takes you longer to cast it, but it will do more damage, or its buff will be better or stuff like that. So it's about juggling that. And obviously, because you can see where the enemies are going to attack you on that timeline, you know, okay, this enemy is going to do an attack on me. What I can do is I can go into the speed lane, and I can cast my attack quicker, and I know that this attack will debuff them to prevent them from attacking next turn. So it's all about juggling that. And then it's further complicated by the fact that each match has, well, each fight has kind of like a randomized effect on it. So it might be, let's say, healing. So it puts a little box on that timeline, and it's like, if you can time it so that when you do, when you set up your attacks, you know you're going to cast it at the time that this box is on the timeline.
Yeah.
You'll get the healing benefit from it. So when that time, when the timeline runs across and it comes to the point that that box is on it, as long as your characters are in it, ready to cast at that point, you'll get healed. And it works for the enemy as well. So what you can do is, if there's like, you can get debuffs, like there will be poison in this field. So what you can do is you can use attacks that push enemies further down the timeline and delays their time to push them to when the poison cloud will appear, and then they'll take damage from that.
That does sound a bit more like interesting and a bit more in depth compared to like just the bog standard, like, you know, turn-based combat that a lot of people are used to.
It reminds me a lot of how card games work, in the fact that kind of like in something like Hearthstone, there are a lot of doing very, very clever plays and understanding that this card will do this, but it's not about what it's doing immediately this turn. It's about the impact it has two turns ahead.
It's just like, it's like chess, isn't it? It's kind of like the oldest of games, like thinking, you've got to think ahead. And like you said about this timeline, is this a timeline that's like constantly ticking, or do you have as long as you need to pick what you want to do?
Because it's fundamentally turn-based, what it is it's essentially showing you what the cooldown is on your attack, right?
Okay.
I attack now, and it means that I have to wait till this far on the timeline until I can attack again. Okay. If you do a casting move, it means you've got to wait for that casting to be able to start. It'll do it, and then it'll show you where you'll be till you can do your next move. So it's all about knowing when to cast or when to do immediate moves, and if you should be doing long waits, short waits, or regular waits, and also balancing that out with how much damage do I want to do, how much do I immediately need healing now, how much do I immediately need to do debuffs on the enemy now. Enemies can do things where they'll be like, oh, this enemy has literally just set a bomb in their hand. The only way you can stop it is by doing a speed move on them now, and that will disarm them. Otherwise, when you kill them, they're going to detonate the bomb and all of your team are going to take damage. So all of these very, very small kind of tweaks make it like a really intricate battle system.
Has League of Legends had like a push like this before? Because it seems like it's like this 1-2 punch combo where you have Arcane, which is like apparently a really brilliant animated series, and then just a really good RPG coming out near enough at the same time. Is this like new for League of Legends to have something like this?
Because Arcane is so story based, there's been kind of like a much bigger push around here to make the universe a bit more front and center. So also very recently, so there are two kind of main League of Legends games. There's League of Legends as the 5v5 MOBA, but there's also Legends of Runeterra, which is their card game, which is a lot like Hearthstone. I actually think it's a little bit better than Hearthstone. But what they've done around here is there is now the single player version of Legends of Runeterra available, which is the other one I would suggest. That's completely free to play, whereas Ruined King is like a £25 like 25-30 hour
RPG. That's playable
RPG
and everything as well. This kind of just, I'm sure there's a lot of Riot fans being like, this hasn't snuck up on anyone, but this game, like, I hadn't heard of it until you said it. It's just a big RPG that's come out for every console that is apparently very, very good.
I'm playing it on PlayStation. It's on PC. It's obviously on Xbox. I think is it on Switch?
It's on Switch.
Well?
Yeah, it's on Switch.
It seems like it's just kind of come out of nowhere. Like, I've never really paid much attention to League at all, but now it's just suddenly like a great push of like three fantastic things to experience.
So I knew Ruined King was in development, so it's not actually been made by Riot. It's part of what's called the Riot Forge, which is Riot are now working with other developers, which I guess are more talented in the regions that they want to expand into. So they've got Airship Syndicate, who have made RPGs before, to build this one. And so you can tell that it's not like, as I say, it's not as high budget as like a, like, you know, when you look at how KDA looks, you know, that tell is an in-house Riot product. Whereas this isn't quite that good, but it's still got like that lovely art style to it. It's that kind of, everything's slightly chunky on the corners and it's slightly painterly. And the same with like Runeterra, you can tell is a Riot game just because it's so fluid with the way it plays. And I think if you're looking to, if you've played Arcane and you want a story that's set in Piltover, like go and play Runeterra, because the first storyline in it, and it plays a little bit like Slay the Spire to a degree, I suppose.
Okay.
But that is set like within the storyline of, not of Arcane the show, but it kind of deals with the central relationship between Jinx and Vi, which is center to kind of Arcane, that is very much dealt with in Runeterra's single player, and that's free to play. Like, if you want to go and play that,
I'm absolutely going to check out Runeterra. You've sold that to me, because I do like my Hearthstone, I like my Slay the Spire, and a free single player, then I'm definitely going to check that out. It's kind of, it's weird. It's what I've wanted for the last 5 years. from Overwatch, I wanted like a big Netflix TV show. I thought it would have been perfect. Like, I thought that would be the hero. Like, shoot, I know League of Legends isn't a hero shooter, but it's a, you know, a massive cast of characters. Yeah. I felt like Blizzard were going to be, because they always did their cinematics. Obviously, we all know what's going on Blizzard the last year or two. Like, they've got other things to worry about right now, so that's not at the forefront of their mind. But yeah, I always thought it's weird to me that I never expected, League of Legends to be the ones that have kind of, I suppose, you know, a lot of credit should actually go to Fortiche as well, the animation company that make Arcane and do all the music videos for Riot. Like, they're just masters. And like, I can't believe this. I now want just as much League of Legends stuff as I can get without actually having any interest in League of Legends.
I was going to say the same thing. This is the first time I've ever had any interest in League of Legends, just from like this sudden influx of fantastic stuff to play and watch as well. It's genuinely quite exciting.
Yeah, it's an exciting time for them. And they've also got, like, the other thing they've announced is there's a League of Legends like assist fighter, so like a street fighter with League of Legends characters. And it genuinely looks like, I'm not into it, those sort amazing. Of games. Yeah, the animation on that is outstanding, and it's always it's like it's still only in R&D, and it already looks
That's
fantastic
mad. They're just going all out.
Season 2 for Arcane already announced as well, like
Jesus,
bring it on.
Absolutely. Also, bring it on. Tell us, Jesse, bring on your thoughts about Battlefield 2042, a big first-person shooter that recently dropped that I know you've played a lot of.
I have played a stupid amount of Battlefield 2042.
Not as good as Halo, is it?
It isn't.
That's my input. Like, that's my only input in this conversation. Exactly. You go for
it. This is the thing. Like, everyone knows what Battlefield plays like. It's the same for Call of Duty as well. It's just one of those things that Battlefield 2042 is just ultimately more Battlefield, and at this point it's just fine. I think for me, I'll always prefer how Battlefield plays compared to something like Call of Duty, just because I prefer those larger maps, you know, where vehicles come into play. But as of now, the core offering of 2042 just feels a bit basic. Like, you know, Breakthrough and Conquest are the modes which have always just been, you know, standard Battlefield fare. It's exactly what you would expect from the game, except this time it now has 128 players over 64. And even for myself, like, as much of a spectacle as that can be, it's a bit too hectic at times. It doesn't feel quite balanced. I don't know, like, what you think about it, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I've not played anywhere. You literally went to the review event. I say went to, like, experienced it from,
sat
from
on
home.
Desk.
Yeah. But you've played a lot more of it than I have, and I've not. I've only put, like, maybe kind of, like, a few hours into each mode at the moment. But my feeling is I've got a lot of very, very fond memories of kind of the earlier era of Battlefield. Like, I was a huge fan of Bad Company 2. Yep. And I was actually quite a big fan of Battlefield 4. But since Battlefield 1, I've kind of tapered off. For me, kind of coming back to it after having, like, not, like, dedicated myself to the series for a while, this feels like the actual idea of Conquest is still there and is pretty much exactly the same game we played. I agree, too many players at that kind of scale. I just feel like... Yeah. You barely get a chance to get started, right?
When you're playing Breakthrough, it is utter chaos. And I would usually be, you know, all for that, but it can be completely overwhelming where there's 128 players, there's like 10 tanks across each team and helicopters flying. Like, it ends up being like what you see in the trailer, which is just complete chaos.
Yeah. By the way, is Breakthrough what I would know as Rush from Bad Company?
Sort of. It's kind of like one team is defending an area, and then when you capture 2 points from the attacking team, you get pushed back.
Classically known as Rush. Right, okay. The one thing that I do that I really don't like, and I feel like the purity of the class system has just been completely disintegrated.
Yeah, exactly. That's my main issue.
I really like, and I think everybody that listens to this podcast knows that kind of like we've all been fans of shooters like Overwatch and specifically Rainbow Six as well. We've played a lot of. And I really like the purity of knowing who the other character is and knowing exactly what the counter is. And I think the beauty of original Battlefield was there were four roles, and it was all about the interplay between these really distinct roles. Like, it was engineers, it was medics, it was assaults, and it was recons. And everybody knew kind of how those roles fitted in, to the point where it was like the engagements distances between certain characters was different to ensure that kind of like this character has the advantage at short range, but this one at longer range and all the way to middle range. And the way
people understood that balance, especially like, you know, I'm going to be the anti-tank person. I'm going to help my team specifically for this round and whatnot. Mm-hmm. That's just, it's completely lost because now they've introduced specialists where You have like maybe I think 12 kind of unique characters, and you know, one of them has a grappling hook, one of them has deployable shields, but all of them can be a sniper, all of them can be able to heal, all of them can have rocket launchers. It's, I'm going to sound like an old man, but I miss just those dedicated classes.
But I think what it seems to have done is, and this is an old man like complaint for Battlefield, but it's a case of no one fucking seems to play it as a team, which I think when there was a much more distinct, like, a weird metaphor, but I think back in the day, Battlefield used to almost be like a jigsaw where there were big pieces that fitted together. And now it's more of a mosaic in that, like, there's so many granular things you can change. It's like, I want to play as this specialist, which means I get this, I get a bulletproof shield, or I get a, you know, a sentry gun. But there's no role for that character to play. It's like you define the role. And from a selfish point of view, that's quite cool because you're like, I want to be like the intel gatherer that's got loads of grenades. So you can sort of say, okay, I'm going to have, use these gadgets which help me gain intel, and I'm also going to have like a load of smoke grenades to deny. Or you can say, I'm just going to be the guy that has so much ammunition on me that I can never stop shooting. But it's like, how does that help the team? And I feel like unless you're playing this with a group of people that have all agreed, like, this is your role in the team, this is your role in the team.
63 of your friends.
Yeah, exactly. But at least, you know, within, like, a squad, you could work. But I felt like no one was fucking playing medic. No one was being, like, a dedicated anti-tank or repair system.
No one is doing that all. And they've shot themselves in the foot, because then you have the other side, which is Battlefield Portal, which people are now playing their favorite Battlefield game sort of remastered with those dedicated classes, and no one wants to play 2042 because the maps aren't particularly great and those classes have been completely dissolved. Like,
well, it was so weird going back, like, I, you know, the after I've played some 2042, I was like, let's see what Portal's all about. Went in, but booted up the rush mode from Bad Company 2. It was on Arica Harbor, my favorite map probably in all of Battlefield. And the fact that it opens up and it's just four classes, and when I open it, like, my medic looks like my medic used to look. He's got the proper defibrillators. When you play the engineer, you've got an anti-tank gun and a tool to fix your own tanks. And, like, all of that, like, I felt like I got a role, whereas before it was, like, make your own role in Battlefield 2042, but also, like, hope for the best that everybody else has decided that they'll choose roles that help the team.
I feel like a lot of these modern first person shooters, especially, you know, the team-based stuff, they've kind of lost that kind of just that dedicated role thing, especially with just like prior Call of Duties and Battlefield, where every character does, like, kind of looks the same. You don't have like those kind of like dedicated, like, just looks for characters on opposing teams anymore, because in Battlefield 2042 everyone could, like, a group of 20 people can look like the same bloke all fighting each other at the same time.
You don't have those clear silhouettes, and that's what something like Overwatch does. So
it just looks genuinely stupid,
and the thing,
like,
is,
no one's a fan of it.
The thing is you, I know you can do it because you play something like Rainbow Six, which does have a very modern military thing, but the moment you see, like, the big motorcycle helmet and the pauldrons, like, you know that's a mirror. The moment you see kind of like the weird headgear, you're like, oh well, that's it's Jackal, isn't it, the guy that that has got the hunting goggles on. You know, like, Rainbow Six does that without giving up the modern military aesthetic. And I just wish, like, I think I've started to figure out, like, there are some specialists that do have that, like the guy that's got the big riot shield. Like, he's wearing an almost Hurt Locker style bomb jacket. And you're like, okay, but I don't know what that tells me about that character other than the fact that he might whip out a bulletproof shield at some point. I don't know what equipment he's using. I don't know if he's an anti-tank. I don't know if he's an anti-infantry. I don't know if he's a medic.
And that's the thing, like, at least, you know, there is the benefit of being able to, like, perfectly curate and, you know, customize your character. So you can still be the sniper who heals or whatever, but it ruins that team play when everyone is their own fucking Rambo.
And that's
Rambo.
The inherent problem of something like a lot of games. It means if everyone can do everything, it means ultimately a meta is going to be found, and everyone's going to just choose the same loadout every time, and it's going to be going to become boring. Like, and that's like, we can compare it to Halo in a way, because that is, to me, what the beauty, we talked about it last week, but I can't stop playing Halo. The beauty of Halo is everyone starts out as exactly the same character, so it forces you to, like, you know, there is no class system, but, you know, everyone is on an even playing field. There is no meta to really be found. And that's what, like, this Battlefield, I haven't played any of, I played a little bit of the beta and I was just bored. Like, just, I don't know, it wasn't doing a lot for me. But it feels like they're not respecting our servicemen. And if the minions told us anything. It's that we should respect our servicemen. There's a old reference for people.
I won't go out on a complete bum note on Battlefield, though. I played some Hazard Zone and I actually quite liked it. I don't think it's something I would dedicate a huge amount of time to. But the thing after playing the standard all-out warfare mode of 2042, it was nice to go into a game mode, which if anybody doesn't know how Hazard Zone works, it's kind of a mashup of Battle Royale and like the Hunt Showdown style of gameplay, there's I think it's 8 teams of 4 drop onto a big map, and all across the map there are sort of locations like there are in a Battle Royale, and they've got items that you need to go and grab, like data discs. And then twice through the match there is an option to extract, and your team then has to run and extract what you've got. And not only are you fighting against the other teams to get those things, but there are also AI controlled like insurgency forces on the map. And the thing that I really liked about that mode was I landed as part of a team and the team stuck together and we fought as a team, because that's the whole idea of the game, is like it's the team. It's not just kind of like how many kills you got or I'm just going to run off and try and capture this point. It was your team has to stay together, otherwise you're going to get eliminated and you're not going to win the game. And I found for once it all kind of clicked and it felt Battlefield-y again, even though the things I was doing wasn't Battlefield. It was like, here's a unit of 4 people trying to work in unison and calling out what enemies they can see and moving across a big bit of terrain. And I was like, if I knew more people that played this, I could probably get into it. I think since they moved to the Frostbite engine, Battlefield feels a bit overly heavy and weirdly floaty. So if it got the gunplay of COD, I would literally be going out and telling people, get this game and let's play together. Yeah. But there's just something about it. Like, it's a good idea that I hope is either picked up by Warzone or like Halo.
That's the problem they have, isn't it? That Halo launched for free the same week they launched. And I've seen, like, that's the problem. Like, Battlefield, it doesn't sound like a bad game. It just sounds like a boring one. And that's not what you want. No one wants to be bored when they're playing a game. And I've seen, like, the headlines, what it's like in the top 10 worst reviewed games on Steam or something.
But also seems the most played as well.
Yeah, but like that seems like people were really just having a moan. Like, it's not broken or anything, what I've heard. Like, it runs well, doesn't it?
It happens with Battlefield 4, Battlefield 1 and 5, where it's like the launch state of these Battlefield games, these prior ones, have always been fairly rocky. And then over time, people end up saying, oh, this has been the best Battlefield since, you know, Battlefield 2, whatever. It always happens with Battlefield games these days. Where
it's that balance, isn't it? Especially, I feel in Battlefield, maybe with more than any other shooter, like, people who love Battlefield, like, really love Battlefield and want it to always be what Battlefield is. But that's the hard balance the developers have, isn't it? Like, making it feel new, but also if you change anything about Battlefield, people will be annoyed. But
Just removing like the leaderboard, people are going nuts about that. Not, like, you're not having any voice chat or being able to, I don't know, like,
not having any voice chat
and stuff.
There's no voice chat. That is mad.
In the world of crossplay, because I am playing it crossplay, and it's like I will always generally go to Discord for crossplay anyway. But the idea of not having in-game voiceover IP on a crossplay seems bananas to me. But we are living in the world of COVID, so
sounds like a disappointment. That's a shame.
Yeah.
But is there anything you really like about it, Jesse? Because we don't want to, like, just sit here shitting
like,
over someone's
game. That's the
thing.
Like, I keep like launching 2042 after work just to play, because I love just, you know, being that anti-vehicle person, or either just spending so much time in vehicles, like getting in a tank, you know, rushing to the objective, helping the teammates. Like, it's a pretty looking game. It sounds great as well. And it's just, it sounds cliche. It's always fun to have those Battlefield moments where you're in a tank and a jet's coming towards you, and, you know, people are rushing in with vehicles and stuff. Like, I love those moments, and I'm still playing Battlefield 2042 despite a lot of issues I'm seeing online. I haven't experienced all of them, but I've already told you guys what I feel anyway. But ultimately, it's fun, just not as great as it could be, but that'll come with patches, most likely.
So you think it's a game that, like, with patches will eventually turn into, like, at least a good tier Battlefield, if not a top tier?
Yeah, 100%. The very same happened with Battlefield 4. That game was clapped at launch, and now it's one of the most well-loved Battlefield games. Like, I have no doubt
the
same can happen
in 2042.
I think
they're in trouble for the next couple of months. They may eventually turn it around, but they've got Halo, which everyone is playing. The new Warzone map comes out in like 2 weeks, which people, you know, Call of Duty will see another rise for a few weeks probably of players. Not that it's ever really fallen off too much for that game, but I hope they turn around, because I do like DICE and I always like what they try and do with games. It just seems like this one's gone a little bit awry.
But they do have like a decent timeline going for DLC, where it's like for Portal, bring back 2142, bring back Vietnam, or even, I don't know, Battlefield 2 maps as well. Like, it seems set in stone there, easy enough for them to kind of grab, but they just need to get those patches out to fix the game.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Right. From one thing that's kind of like a partial dud, but with real promise for where it could go, to something that's just an all-out dud, I'm afraid.
Oh, we don't need to talk about Jesse like that.
No, but I know, I'm sorry, Jesse, because I know that you've got some hope for this, but...
Mate, I knew going in that this wasn't going to be great. Like, obviously talking about Resident Evil and Welcome to Raccoon City.
Obviously, obviously we're talking about that. Yeah.
But, go ahead, Matt. Yeah. What do you think about the film?
Well, you will have noticed on IGN.com that the review landed not so long ago. And I believe we gave it, let me just IGN
6.
Same score as Licorice Pizza, isn't it?
Why are we talking about that?
It's just what came to mind.
Yeah, we gave it 2 days ago. Taylor, who reviewed it, gave it a 6 out of 10. She said it was okay. Sticks admirably
she's a
close.
Massive Resi fan as well.
Yeah. Sticks admirably close to its source material, but an overly stuffed story and a rushed third act hold it back. I would say the fact that it's just kind of a badly written script that's kind of mediocrely directed is probably the thing that holds it back the most.
So I was going to ask, like, how rushed does this film feel? Because, like, I think every fan has always echoed it, that you have the formula of do Resident Evil 1 as a film. If that does well, do 2 and then 3, and then you can do whatever you want afterwards. But since they've, like, mashed Resident Evil 1 and 2 together, like, how much does it suffer for it?
To me, that's kind of like... its ultimate sin is that it's a bit boring and kind of feels...
Wicked, that's what you want.
it is like the... If I was a, like... Because I do like Resident Evil, but let's imagine I was a Resident Evil super fan and I went to uni and I did film production and I made my Resi fan movie as, like, my final
project.
Oh, it'll
be like that.
It does feel a bit like that. Like, the complaints about it looking slightly cosplay-y does, run through and... They obviously were not given a good effects budget because, oh boy, do the lickers and stuff like that look bad. But also kind of like it never explores its characters because what it's trying to do is it's trying to tell two stories. So you never really get anything more about Leon other than the fact that, oh, he's the rookie. And because you're not spending any time with him, you don't. Resident Evil characters are not super beyond the surface. Like, they're all kind of designed as archetypes. But there is more to these characters than
absolutely.
Just, like, what you write on paper when you're filling in a form about them.
Yeah, and their first games will then, you know, launch into, like, a storied kind of fucking history with these guys. And the fact that they've just, like, crashed these two games into
Tell
one
me
film.
About the Zombos. What are the Zombos
I mean,
like?
Yeah, are the zombies actually good in this?
I mean, I wouldn't say they're scary. They are at least, like, humans. Like, don't
Have
know.
You
they
ever been scared by a zombie, though? Has anyone ever really been? I'm not talking about real zombies, obviously, don't Well, as far as we know, what are the deep state not telling us? We don't know. But
I feel like 28, like, weeks later or 28 days later, the zombies in that, like, are pretty fucked. I would hate to imagine myself in that scenario.
They're probably up there as scariest zombies. But yeah, Resident Evil zombies, like, you can outrun them with a brisk walk.
I mean, they are definitely made a little faster in this. They're not quite as shambly, but my key problem with it is that basically, so you've got, it's trying to do the events of Resident Evil 1, which is like Briar team going to the Spencer Mansion, right, to investigate what happens, and it's also doing Leon's, like, it's not his first day on the job, but it's his, like, he's definitely, like, early into the job. And, like, the idea of the city falling and also the William Birkin kind of storyline. But it's also like a prequel to all of this. So what it does mean is, and I don't know if this was a budgetary concern thing, so you make sure that you don't have as much action going on. The first half is largely just people kind of sitting around going, bit weird in Raccoon City, isn't it?
That's what I remember from Resident Evil, the really long dialogue option scenes where you're just talking about, you know, should this triangle piece of the puzzle go in the triangle slot or do we need, like, something else? I don't know.
But my thing is it does things like there's, like, a long scene, like, in a bar, which feels like it's designed to try and introduce, like, Leon, Wesker and Jill and kind of, like, set up there. But it's just them just, like, talking about nonsense and it doesn't feel like it builds character and it doesn't feel like it builds story. But what this means is that they don't actually go to the Spencer Mansion until kind of like about the halfway point. Which largely means that then you're very limited about what you can do in the Spencer Mansion, because you're quite far through a film that is not actually that long. So, you know, kind of like, I won't spoil, obviously, like, if you know the stories of Resident Evil, you largely know where this is going. But I won't sort of spoil what you're going to see. But I will say, don't go in expecting, like, any of the cool shit that was under the Spencer Mansion. Don't expect any of those kind of fun moments.
Does a dog jump through a window?
No.
Okay, what's the point?
And also, from Claire and Leon's perspective, don't expect to really see inside the police station, because what you get is you get like the interior, like foyer of it, but so, there's no exploration of the halls. There's no kind of like the helicopter crashing into the side of it.
So it's not really welcome to Raccoon City. It's more like, here's a bit of Raccoon City. Now we're going to go.
Jesse looks so confused and upset because I know how much this means to him.
That's the thing, like the Paul W.S. Anderson films, right?
Better than those. I'll give it that.
That's what I was going to say. Like, those films are like just complete dog shit. You had something a little bit unique with the first one, and the second film they pretty much just did like Resident Evil Nemesis and stuff. But to hear that, I want to see these characters actually, you know, struggle through something so terrifying as going through the Spencer Mansion and seeing those characters build up there. Not seeing them fucking around eating fucking sandwiches in a bar and stuff. Like, I don't need to see that. And that's the thing, like, with this film, because, you know, I'm very much love Resident Evil. I'm sure I'm going to pick up the Easter eggs and stuff that. But that doesn't make a film for me. Nah. Like, you know, people are going to love that stuff, but that's not the reason why I'm going to watch it.
You did actually touch on something very important there. And what do you think Wesker's favourite sandwich would be?
I feel like he's just cucumber and tuna or something.
That was weird. Tuna mayo came to my head as well.
He seems like a boring dickhead.
Yeah, I feel like tuna mayo. Maybe a bit of sweet corn on a Thursday if he's feeling a bit frisky. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
There are, So, like, Wesker is in there, and it's kind of like, it's nice to see these characters. Like, Barry Burton isn't, which I was quite surprised.
Yeah, there's certain characters who are omitted just for, just fuck it, who cares?
Where's the love for Barry Burton? But, and like, it splits it a bit, so you don't have so much of the, like, Claire and Leon doing kind of like their A and B sort of plot lines, or it doesn't quite do that. But, like, Chief Irons is in it. I must say, it does some stuff to kind of like set up the idea of, because as we know from the games, like Umbrella are trying to contain it, right?
Yeah.
It does like one scene to deal with that, and then it's almost like they forgot that that was in the movie.
So I just want to ask, like, Umbrella, I don't know if it's, but to be fair, Resident Evil fucking storylines have been out here for 20, 30 years now, so it's not really like news, but do you not see Umbrella trying to contain it with like the UBCS? Because they have their own armed forces. Do you not see him like any of them?
You are going to see some like hunk style looking dudes.
Blokes.
But it very quickly forgets that it sets this plot line up, and sort of like by the end of it, you don't really get any. Like, the thing I like about those like initial stories, and especially kind of the Resi 2 one, is the idea of it's like, oh, they fucked up the water supply and they've destroyed this city and now they've got to do something about it. And whilst you do get resolution to that, and like there is a visual representation of that, I just feel like it never like connects the dots properly. And I think it is a game, like it's a film that is designed for people that have played those games. Yes. Like if you've played them, you're going to see all the references and you're going to know like, oh, okay, I know what the reason why this thing happened with Chief Irons is related to what's happening here. But the whole cohesion of it, I just don't think makes any sense if you haven't played the first two games. But if you have played the first two games, what you're getting here is something that you basically didn't want.
that's what I was going to ask as well. Like, is there any appeal to be had for someone who doesn't know much about Resi? Because you think about like, you know, good or decent zombie films, you have, you know, Dawn of the Dead, 28 Days Later, and stuff like that, where you're not really tied down to having fan service and stuff, you know?
What you're going to get is, if you've never played a Resident Evil game, you're going to come in and go, why the fuck are there these two storylines that barely, like, are connected, that don't really make sense, like, as why they're happening at the same time, that are only connected because there's an office in the police station where these STARS people are in it for so long. They're just sitting in that office for so long because they won't go on the fucking Resident Evil 1 mission. It's like, just go on the mission. Get the film going. and they just don't. But that's exactly what Taylor was saying in her review, is that it means that, like, because so much of it is, like, I think from maybe the old like horror school idea of, like, the alien doesn't turn up in Alien until like 45 minutes to an hour into that film, and the whole point is to build that tension. Resi's not a series necessarily about tension in that way. It's supposed to be a bit of a cheesy horror. So get the cheesy horror moments going from the moment it starts, please.
Yeah, it could have just been them in the helicopter, and then the dogs come out. They're in the forest and stuff. Yeah. Like, just see those
twist
moments.
Twist it around. Start it how, like, a strong opening is how Resi 2 starts with the car crash. Like, that is a good opening. Yeah. So,
you do get all of, like, you get the helicopter, you get the truck with the, literally to the point where the burger looks so identical to the Resi 2 rendering of the burger in the truck. You're going to get all that. But, like, I just ultimately think, like, all of these characters are, like, so muted in this. They're so boring. There's only really Leon that I liked in it. And I just think, like, if
just
you
watch
just,
a YouTube playthrough of someone playing it.
If you just spent time, like, choose one of these stories, because they sucked out, for me, what are the most interesting parts of those stories. There's not the sense of discovery of the Spencer Mansion, and there's not the sense of, like, gothic oppression of walking around this spooky police station that used to be like an art gallery, right? So it's got these big, like, vaulted ceilings and weird, like, clock tower moments. Like,
see, that requires money. And what you've said is that this film doesn't have any.
So, no, largely saved to do the end, which is very much taken quite a lot from Resident Evil 2. Like, you're going to get, like, the subway cars and those kind of things.
I'm just expecting shit to blob. Like, I'm going to watch this film just thinking this is another just standard affair, and I'm going to enjoy it by turning my brain off and not having to worry about why the stories are fucked.
This is only in cinemas as well, isn't it, at the moment? It's not streaming.
That is mad.
Good luck to him.
It does feel like a direct-to-DVD, unfortunately.
Well, this, like, has been a lot of disappointments one after another, isn't it?
I just, like... just wish that I just even got, like, a glimmer of joy out of watching things that I know from the game appear on the thing.
So bad.
I'm sorry.
That's the opposite. You know, we've got Arcane. Not everything can be great.
So that is a disappointment. Not so much of a disappointment is Hawkeye, the new Marvel show on Disney Plus. Have we all watched Hawkeye?
I've watched the first two because I'm committed to the cause, and I also have the whole week off, so why wouldn't I? Matt, you've reviewed it, though.
I am back on MCU TV review duties. I am a big fan of the Matt Fraction, and we'd normally, you know, you call them David Adja because that's what it looks like, but it's actually like David Aja, he's Spanish. So we'll try and give him the correct dues. But this series takes a lot from their comic, which was the kind of reinvention of Hawkeye as a much more, for my money, interesting kind of character, and united him with Kate Bishop, who is this kind of young archer that sees kind of like a lot in Hawkeye and kind of almost like his protege. And within the Hawkeye TV show, she's played by Hayley Steinfeld, which I think is probably the most on-point casting that this entire project has done since they cast Chris Evans as Captain America.
She's fantastic. And I really I really like the opening as well, how they actually... It's not just, oh, she's a good archer. They do a really good job of tying her instantly to Hawkeye from like there's a opening of the show, I'm not spoiling, and there's a flashback to when she's a child, and that I think that's a really cool way that they've done that.
So what unfolds from there is Hawkeye is basically a Christmas show. It's kind of formulated around the old age classic of, will Dad get home in time for Christmas? And the six episodes, and each episode ticks down a day until Christmas. Like, it opens with the idea it's 6 days to Christmas. Hawkeye is with his children in New York. He's taken them to see, as you might have seen in the trailer, there's like Steve Rogers, the musical.
Not cheap looking musical as well.
Cheap ass looking.
I enjoyed the musical number in that. I thought it was good stuff.
But then his children are going back home to go with his wife, Linda Cardellini. And basically Hawkeye's like, I'll be back. I've just got a little bit to do in New York. And then Kate Bishop turns up and things go a little bit awry for poor Hawkeye, who basically just wants to go home and drink
eggnog. I thought you just
eggnog.
Called him Paul Hawkeye. That'd be great Hawkeye. If his real name was Paul Hawkeye.
I think that's one of the things I kind of appreciate about the opening of the first episode is just seeing these, you know, superheroes, despite Hawkeye being the most human out of the most of them, really, just in a more human setting. Like, he's basically distraught from previous battles. He's, you know, banged up. He's got a hearing aid and stuff. And you can't exactly make, you know, a show about superheroes having PTSD because that would be depressing as fuck. But
well, they tried with Falcon more... Winter Soldier.
Yeah, yeah.
And it got quite dull.
Yeah. But I guess, like, sprinkles of that where you haven't seen that in any of the films is appreciated.
Yeah, I think it probably goes well with the Christmas theme because obviously Christmas can sometimes be like a melancholic sort of time, especially if you can't spend it with your family. And Hawkeye, basically, because Kate Bishop turns up, and we won't spoil it for anybody that hasn't watched it, but kind of means that he has to stay in the city now. He kind of, like, it does sort of suit that thing. And, like, obviously the death of Black Widow is kind of hovering over him. Like, he was there when Black Widow kind of died in Endgame. And like you say, kind of like in the comics, Hawkeye is death. Kind of it was a big part of the Matt Fraction and David Aja run. And has been part of Hawkeye's backstory going back to like 1983, I think was the first time that he was made deaf.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And like in the show, they actually show it, like he's got a hearing aid in the show. It's explained like, what else do you expect? He's been in the firing line. Like in Endgame, he's like underneath where kind of like the fucking Thanos's capital ship like crashes into, shoots up and blows up the Avengers compound. So of course he's got hearing damage. Like it's only natural. Yeah. He's a human. It does one thing that I really like, which is it recognizes that Hawkeye's a bit boring and kind of needs a bit of a reinvention. There is a lovely scene. Is it in the episode that you've watched or is it in the second episode, Jesse, where they're in? Have you not seen it yet?
No, but I've seen it like on, I've seen the actual clip, which I'm kind of looking
it's been around, but there's a lovely bit where they're in New York and in Times Square and there's a group of cosplayers and Kate Bishop's like, look, people love, like there are people there dressing you. And he's like, no, look, the archer among this group of Avengers cosplayers is actually Katniss Everdeen from the Hunger Games. And it's this kind of fun recognition that like, while there are people that are out there that admire him, like nobody's necessarily really going to bat for Hawkeye all the time. And it's kind of this cheeky in-universe nod to the fact that like, we know he's just the dude with the bow and arrow. We know you like Tony Stark. We know you like Chris, you know, you like Captain America and all of that, but we're going to try and do something to make him a bit more fun. And Kate is positioned as this more wild card, like very loose cannon archer who's constantly getting herself into trouble. She's positioned as a sort of the person that's going to push him into a more interesting kind of position. And I think, like, you know, hands up, I think that Hawkeye is quite boring in the MCU. I don't think Jeremy Renner, like, makes him particularly interesting. No. This could be the show that makes him empathetic and makes him worth caring about.
Yeah, like, I liked him when he was being, like, him and Black Widow scenes are always his best bits because he's showing genuine emotion, he has something to care about, whereas other times it just feels like, yeah, he is along for the ride. And, like, it is nice to see him get a bit of... Because I do think he's a good actor, he's just not had a lot to do with Hawkeye in the MCU films before, and he is getting more to do in this. I like in... Like, the second episode, there is a bit where I really like the first episode, and I do like the second episode a lot. There's a section of it, though, I was just like, this is a bit silly. What are we doing here? Like, this is... Like, I know he's not the cool... He's just a man. He's a dad, and he's not the coolest Avenger. He is still an Avenger. He would not have to do what he's doing here, which kind of almost goes into, like, silly sitcom territory at times.
I think
I know the bit Matt's talking about.
Like
in the second... Yeah, it's... But I'm really enjoying it. Yeah, it's a solid start. So far I think we spoke about it before, it's the same as all the other TV shows where they're all solid, like seven, like good, they're just very enjoyable. They don't seem like they're going to change the MCU in big ways. This one, not necessarily, I don't think is meant to. It's just meant to be a nice Christmas show.
I think the thing that I like is it pays so much lip service to those comics to the point that like the opening credits are literally drawn in the art style of the covers of those comics. And the great thing about those Hawkeye comics was that they weren't trying to change the MCU. And it's what I like about the comics in general. A lot of people, and I've seen reviews around Hawkeye, that have really slammed it because they're like, it's completely inessential. But the thing is, that's how so Marvel Comics television. Works. Well, yeah, there is that. But the thing is when you, I think if you come from the world of comics, not every comic is designed to be essential. It's just like, if you like this character, here's like a really cool run where they're doing things. It's not moving and shaking the Marvel universe as we know it and causing Thanos to come down. Or like, sometimes it's just good to have a character-focused piece that doesn't have to worry about the overall storyline of the Marvel universe.
Well, it was just very refreshing for me compared... So last week, I actually saw Eternals, which we haven't spoken about. I'll very briefly talk about Eternals, which I just found to be quite boring and quite a trudge. Like, it's... Like, and that's got massive, grand, universal, like, ideas and things it's trying to get across. Like, and it's just a bit of a boring mess for me. Like, there's bits to like about that film, but for large portions of it, I was just bored. I think something went wrong with that film. But it's just nice to be back on solid ground. And, it made me feel quite Christmassy. I know we're still weeks away from Christmas, but it had sort of that, you know, Christmas in New York. I just think of Home Alone 2, and then I think of Christmas, and that, it's just very nice.
Yeah, there might be a bit of that Home Alone to it as well, because, like, Kate has that sort of vibe, right? Like, she's like using tools that she shouldn't be using and getting into like adult she is obviously like 22 years old or whatever, but getting into the business of her like very very rich mother and like all of the kind of like security business that she runs, there is that kind of vague Home Alone vibe to it. And I just like, I can't stress enough how fucking brilliant Hailee Steinfeld is in this. She is exactly what I thought that character would be when I read that character on the page. The way that she is in this show is that, and I think, like, I do think her actual family problems are a bit boring, and I hope that they get a lot more interesting as the show goes on, because I think that's like a weaker side of the show at the moment. But when she's with Hawkeye and just forcing him to get into trouble that he doesn't want to be in, I think it's got such a zippy tone to it, and it's really quite joyful. And I hope it emphasizes that rather than its lesser side.
Exactly. I'm looking forward to it every week, which I haven't... Yeah, I wasn't necessarily... Like, I haven't watched all of What If. I wasn't overly into those. Like, it's just nice to have something weekly to watch.
Yeah, yeah. What If was one which I started on the bandwagon of. I loved the idea of lots of different ideas. And then as it went on, I became less and less invested in it. Yeah. Anyway, something that I think you are invested in, Cardi, are the Beatles. Yes.
I do like the Beatles, a little known band from the UK. Had a few hits in the 60s. If you ask me, they're the greatest band that ever lived, but that's not really an unoriginal opinion. And it's one that actually gets people quite angry when you say you like the Beatles sometimes, weirdly. But I love the Beatles, and Peter Jackson has been teasing this for a long time now. It's kind of... It's a documentary, but it's originally just meant to be a 2-hour film in cinemas, which he did, of course, the usual Peter Jackson thing doing, split it into 3 parts and now made it 8 hours long.
Jesus Christ.
So today, we're recording this on Thursday, today part 1 dropped. I'm 2 hours into it. It's 2.5 hours long, the first part. So I'm enjoying it a lot. But with that 8 hours comes the inherent issues. So the setup for this documentary is it gives you right at the start a 10-minute, like, very brief, like, whistle stop tour of the Beatles' history from like 1960 to 1969, where this documentary is set. It's them having not played a live show in a few years after stop touring, just because they weren't enjoying it anymore and no one's actually listening to their music, just screaming. So they've released a few albums in that time, and they're planning their new album. And they're planning to do their first live performance in a long time. And they're kind of building up to that. And with 2 weeks to go, they're still writing songs for this show and this album. And part of the joy of this is you're seeing all this. There's 60 hours of footage they found that was filmed during this run-up that they've cut down to 8 hours, but restored it. And he's kind of done the job he did, but not quite to the same extent of when he made the World War One film. We Shall Remember, They Shall Be They Shall Grow Old. They Shall Not Grow Old. That's it. They Shall Not Grow Old. It looks amazing. It sounds amazing. And as a big Beatles fan, like Abbey Road and Let It Be, two of my favourite Beatles albums, and you're seeing a lot of those songs being written. So they were kind of made in a weird like all in one go in a weird way over the same time, like being written together almost, although they were released at separate times. And I'm seeing some of my favorite Beatles songs kind of being written before my eyes, and like Paul McCartney just like fiddling with his guitar and coming up with like little patterns, and like it's interesting to see that. But yeah, the inherent problem is this already, this first episode is 2.5 hours long, covers the first 7 days of this period, and got Peter Jackson needs an editor. Like, I'm not saying I should do it, I'd happily do it, but like, although all of it is kind of interesting to me as a Beatles fan, seeing all these little conversations, there's like whole 10 minute long like little nattering conversations between like George Harrison and John Lennon and Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr that could be cut down to 1 minute soundbite of like, this is the essence of what they're speaking about here. They keep they have one of their I can't remember if he's the producer or their new manager, he's kind of part of the record company, keeps suggesting they do this live show in an amphitheater in Libya with and he keeps saying, imagine it, torch lit with 200 Arabians. It's like, what's going on? And everyone's just like, and Ringo's just like, I'm not going abroad. And like, obviously the build up to this is the very famous Beatles concert of them on top of the Apple building in central London. Like, that is where this, I imagine this whole series is going to crescendo at the end, is this live show in full, which I can't wait to see because I've only ever seen bits of it and not properly remastered. But yeah, I'm just, even as a huge Beatles fan, I'm just like, this is a bit of a schlep. Like, can't, like, move this along. Like, second part is tomorrow, third part is Saturday, so they're releasing them three parts over 3 days. Of course I'm going to watch it all, but it's turned from something that I was like, I sat down, no distractions, I'm going to soak this all in, to within half an hour, I was like, on my phone, I was like, come, like, let's move this along. Like, I'm getting little bits of the songs, like, I'm hearing I've Got a Feeling and Don't Let Me Down, which are, like, two of my favourite songs, but then I'm also getting 15 minutes of them talking about, like, oh, should we get the 8-track machine in now, or should we get it in later? I'm just like, I don't... Like, to some people, this will be the best thing ever. This should be the best thing ever to me. I'm still having a very good time. I just cut out, you know, there's some rough edges, but I would say, like, although it does give you a brief history of the Beatles, like, you won't be lost if you want to watch this and you're not a Beatles fan. I don't think you'll be getting a lot unless you really know Let It Be and Abbey Road. Like, I don't think you're getting a whole lot from this if you're not into the Beatles.
For me, it's more just of like, I want to see that creative process on screen, kind of like unscripted, and compared to, because I don't have much love for the Beatles, but it'll be interesting to see that.
It is very interesting to see how, some of the greatest songwriters ever are sitting there just fiddling with guitars and pianos and going, oh, what if we did this? And you're hearing different lyrics to songs, you know? Well, that is very interesting. But at the same time, if you don't know these songs, I imagine it could be a little bit tedious.
I also watched another Netflix musical-related film. There's other artistic merits going on Netflix at the moment, isn't there?
Exactly. It's quite closely linked. I watched Tick, Tick, Boom, which is Lin-Manuel Miranda's first film as a director. He never didn't direct the film of Hamilton or In the Heights. But those are both, I really enjoy both of those. They're very fun. Tick, Tick, Boom is the story of Jonathan Larson, who is the creator of the musical Rent, which is a very beloved musical. I've never seen Rent, so I just went into this thinking this will be a fun Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of musical biopic film. It's kind of not. I also found it quite a bit boring, sadly. The one thing I will say is Andrew Garfield plays Jonathan Larson. Andrew Garfield is absolutely fantastic. Like, I think he's always brilliant, to be fair, but he's going for this, like, he's singing, he's like just like 2 hours of pure just this ball of nervous energy. He's amazing. But it's
actually him singing.
I believe so. I didn't look it up, but it sounds like it's him. I'd be surprised if it wasn't.
I've never known him to be a singer, but that's interesting.
Yeah, but the problem is that kind of it's all about the creative process, but it's not necessarily the creative process of Rent. It's all about him when he's about to turn 30 and he's developing his first musical, which is called Superbia. And a lot of the songs from this are from Superbia, which just aren't really great. They're fine, I think. They don't grab you. They're kind of very traditional, like, musical theatre songs, and that's what a lot of the songs are in this. You're not getting really that Lin-Manuel Miranda that you kind of know his songs, like a lot of hip-hop influences song, a lot of dance music, a lot of sort of like Caribbean like flavors to a lot of his songs in his films. Like this is just very much using Jonathan Larson's music, and it's mainly Andrew Garfield and a piano, and I don't know, I expected it to be quite fun. It's not very fun. It's kind of quite a serious biopic and tackles right. some issues that were prevalent in the 90s, and yeah, I was just, maybe I was just in the wrong zone. I was going in expecting one thing and I got something else. Not a bad film, I just thought I was kind of, I didn't find that that creative process was necessarily that interesting to me. It's just kind of watching one man struggle to write a musical for 2 hours.
Great.
Seems like the Beatles.
Well, yeah, but the problem is the Beatles made some of the best music ever. And I don't think the music from Superbia, a musical that didn't even get picked up by Broadway, is as good. It's a shame. Yeah. But as I said, I think Andrew Garfield is absolutely brilliant in it.
He seems a nice man. I've seen the clip that's going around of him talking about art and grief, which is like a 2:40 clip of him with Stephen Colbert that will basically make you cry within that space. It's he seems a guy that's like really plugged in. Mm-hmm. I like Andrew Garfield a lot.
Yep.
Anyway, it's
maybe we'll see him in Spider-Man soon.
Yeah, well, who knows? We're definitely hoping for it.
Bring him back.
It is, for obviously none of you lot that are listening know exactly where we are in time and space. It's after hours on a Thursday evening. I'm making the executive decision. We're canning off the endless search this week.
Spurs do kick off in 3 minutes, so that, you know, how much this podcast means to me, that I'm running into the start of a Spurs match versus the mighty NS Mura of Slovenia, may I add?
Well, we'll get on with it then. We're going straight into feedback. I'm going to go first. I've got one in here from Scott Zeal, who says, "Hey all, love the show as always. Very quick, just on what Joe mentioned about non-gamers struggling with either gaming controls or not understanding regular mechanics in games. Last night, my girlfriend was watching me play Forza Horizon 5 and asked if she could have a go. She doesn't play games and actively dislikes whenever I've tried to get us to play something together, so I was excited that she took an interest. I went back to the garage and bought her real-world car in the game so that she could drive that. We paint it, get it... We paint it, we get it ready to drive, and then once it's out in the open world, I hand her the controller. Controller in hand and looking at the car, she immediately pulls left trigger, which is brake and reverse, and we see the car hurtle backwards towards the camera and smash into something. I chuckled and asked why did she press reverse, to which she responded, "Well, how do I know which button is accelerate?" I stopped for a moment and couldn't justify at all why her choice was wrong. I did wonder if maybe the triggers represent the real-world position of car pedals with accelerate on the right and brake on the left, but otherwise, I had never thought about it before. Thanks as always, and for God's sake, respect the sea. From Scott. Now, originally, I did think of that thing of like, well, it's accelerate because it's on the right. It's what you put with your right foot. But that's actually, in the grand scheme of games, is a reasonably modern invention to have accelerate on the triggers.
It used to just be X.
X used to be go. Yeah. And so you wouldn't fucking think about that, would you, if you'd never played a video game before?
I don't know. I suppose it's just one of those things that's, you just know, isn't it? It's like you say, it's just second nature. Like,
It's really weird.
I think
you
the primary
think
function on a controller is going to be R2, whether it's a gun trigger or an accelerate. I just know that that's going to be there. I mean,
I think the prevalence of shooters and the idea that shooters are on triggers, because they've pretty much always for first person games, as long as they've been triggers on controllers, they've used them. And I think because shooters became such a big deal post Halo, they were then like, okay, well, like the trigger has become like the dominant thing, like you pull your right finger to trigger. So then I think it then made so much sense to put accelerate on there.
I think also, like, just from memory, like holding an X to accelerate for minutes long around a track, that can hurt your thumb after a while. Like holding a trigger doesn't really hurt.
It's too why, much. Like in Avengers, I immediately remapped like the punch to the triggers, because it's like I can use triggers a lot more easily than I can slamming face buttons. Oh, and if the thing that I'm doing most of the time is hitting things, I do that.
Makes sense.
I've never done that for anything other than a racing game. That's funky. Makes sense.
Funky.
Moving on, Jesse, you've got a nice one here from Matt Buckner.
Yeah, he goes on to say, "Hi guys, first of all, a lot of people write in and sound very well written. This isn't my case, but you seem friendly enough not to mind.
It's a good start.
I know it's not even It is. I know it's not even December yet, but bear with me. I'm trying to prepare a very personal and weird Christmas present for my boyfriend, and I could really use some help. My partner and I have been addicted to you guys' voice since we discovered the podcast and really enjoy your chats, but he gets a bit lost when you talk about food because we live in... and he hasn't tried out this magical leisure food. My idea is to scan the area to try and find the delicacies you mentioned in previous episodes. Packaged flapjack, Muller Corners, Walker Crisps. I even managed to get my hands on... Does that say Knopper?
Oh, no, not Knopper. It's pronounced Knopper, I found out. Yeah,
Knopper, yeah. Right,
you need to listen to this podcast. So you're missing out on Knopper knowledge. Knowledge.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It would be great if you could recommend some more of the British leisure foods that you think represents British everything a... something should know about our rich British culture, or that is just proper tasty, whatever you like. I live about 50 oh god, doesn't live too far from the sea, bike past it every day, and I can tell you that fucker must be respected. Thanks so much for your help and for all the laughs you bring to us on a weekly basis.
British leisure foods, what can we Walker's crisps. I would suggest you get some hot and spicy knickknacks.
Would you consider pork scratchings, maybe? I don't know if that's
you would
a bit
consider
too,
that British. I don't like them, though. Scampi fries.
I love them.
The crisp scampi fries and frazzles or bacon rashers.
These do all seem like shit that old people eat, rather than like yeah. Muller Corners, Walker's Crisp, Packaged Flapjack. Like, they don't have like a boomer association with them.
What's the young hip food that you would suggest?
I'm trying to think of something that's just...
Nothing so, British, like katsu curry.
Beef Wellington.
Avocado. I don't think we could suggest beef Wellington as a leisure food.
No. Saurine. Malt loaves.
Saurine is banging, to be fair.
Chocolate mini rolls. Always good.
Crisp sandwich.
Maybe over the next week or two, we think about this and we come back with a few more leisure foods.
Jaffa cakes.
That's
absolute
a great shout.
Absolute Jaffa cakes.
Yep, we'll come back with some suggestions over because I'm sure people like Dale, Al, Emma, who do I miss?
Joe.
Miss Joe there. He'll definitely have some suggestions for this. So we'll come back and we'll think of some British leisure foods. Fruit pastels or wine gums, are they British or are they just general?
They're Maynards, aren't they? So yeah. British company, but... I don't know.
Yeah. I've got the last email here from Cody Miller. As always, you can send in your feedback to IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com. Cody says, "Hi there, UK team. Love the pod. Been listening for ages. Just a small moment made me laugh this week. During the Endless Starch, the clue was open world survival where you go from one alcoholic drink to the next. And me, playing along, shouted, 'It's Winecraft, you dum-dums.' That would also have worked very well.
Fucking hell.
When to my surprise, Matt guest Pub Nautica. Was it you, Matt, who guest Pub Nautica?
I think it was
yeah. Jesse.
Absolutely, Matt would have done
was
that.
It? Oh, there we go. I was tickled to find there was more than one correct answer. I also can't wait to watch Licorice Pizza, but I'm surprised that you lot didn't seem to get the reference. Licorice Pizza is a slam term for a record because it's black and circular, which is why it's the name of the record store. I did actually know that.
I will admit that, but I was asking these two.
I just want people to know I do know my Licorice Pizza knowledge.
Best
film in a long time, so you should definitely go and see that. All the best and respect the SEA. Respect the SEA. Fantastic.
Oh, thank you, Cody.
What an enjoyable podcast that I've gone back into hosting mode. Matt,
you take us out, Cardi.
So I take us out.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's only one bit of music we can really end this week, and it's got to be a bit of Beatles, because rarely will I ever get the chance to have some Beatles on the podcast.
Is there a Christmas Beatles tune?
Absolutely.
Or does that not really
Well, there
exist?
Might be, but why don't we go with, because the Beatles documentary is called Beatles Get Back, why don't we go with like the first 30-40 seconds of the song Get Back, which is
absolute
an absolute
banger. I support this move.
Let's do it. Goodbye.
Right. See ya.
Bye.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's H-Y-P-E-R-T-H-E-T-I-C-A-L.